This is side two of session number 44, recorded on June 18th, 2007. So you started to say something with the global mind or something?
Yeah. I don't know if that's the right word, because that's kind of maybe too occult for LaRouche, but the fact that he's tapped into, he's interested, really interested in the well-being of people, of country, of the economic system in different countries around the world, and he wants to, you know, he's not just interested in America. He's, you know, so, but, and because he's got his agents all over the world in different countries who are collecting information and sending it back to central headquarters, he's got a global perspective that, you know, probably, you know, our part of politicians or any other politicians are just pretty much interested in the survival of their tribe. And, he, you know, LaRouche, you know, seems to be interested in humanity's survival. He's not tribal in that way.
Okay, well, that's why I have him in the newspaper quadrant on my chart. He represents the 19th century, now a meme. It's not a constitutive reality. But the newspaper reality of the 19th century, where there was the growth of nations and the education of the citizen on literate industrial levels, and what we call the humanitarian movement, was a product of that era. And so he categorizes all the issues in these different nominally defined countries, and they have middle classes or incipient middle classes that are hoping there's a role for them. But the fact is that they're all inside the World Bank or the IMF and the digital economy that comes out of the image of the White House, what I call the Android meme. So that he's replaying a literacy which is not the facts of the global economy now. So he represents an old form of intellectual enterprise or an agenda. So I call it the newspaper meme. So you do get information about what goes on in capital cities of these countries and who's the prime minister or president and what legislatures are mandating and the different bureaucratic political factions. When you look at America and you say the politicians are tribal, well, they represent iconic TV images and regions of the United States. So that the modern American politician is geared to the effect of television, and LaRouche is running a rearguard action of hoiking up industrial newspaper realities and categories.
Mm-hmm.
So when he says at the end of this quote we just did, he says, "We counterpose earned profit of physically productive enterprise," he counterposes that to the merely nominally earned profit, earned in quotes, earned profit and interest of usurious activities. So he's talking about, with the phrase earned profit and interest, the stock market and the hedge funds and the digital software economy, which he says doesn't produce the world of tax derivatives, is what he's against. He says the economy is measured on that, and it's not real wealth. The real wealth is hardware stuff, machine tools, which he calls physically productive enterprises, the earned profit of physically productive enterprises. So that's the dialectic there. Hardware, LaRouche's hardware, and new kinds of hardware versus the software tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say he has a humanitarian and universal view, that's the that universal humanitarian enlightened perspective is a perspective engendered by visual space and the newspaper phase of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the issues that he's dealing with are very real to human beings. He's dealing with, you know,
the chemical body,
putting food in your stomach and make clothing on your body. And
he's dealing with the chemical body issues.
Yeah.
And the American politicians and European politicians deal with the TV body.
Mm-hmm.
And the TV body is a stronger environment than the industrial body. The industrial body is marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
But people are gradually waking up and seeing the intangible inflationary discounted effect of the TV body and the chip body, and they're saying, hey, there's no solidity here for the chemical body. So there's a in the West a revulsion, an attempted revolt against this, expressed by the horror of the chemical body being blown up in Iraq. That's the that's the unconscious icon of what's going on to the chemical body. It's being blown up. But people are really concerned about the education of their kids or the future of their jobs and all that hardware stuff, which resonates with LaRouche's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an interesting confluence of the effect of the chip body is people are beginning to wonder, well, are we ever going to retrieve our chemical bodies?
Yeah. But on the issue of people being blown up in Iraq, people have always been blown up in wars, and wars have been going on ever since man could throw a rock.
Yeah, but not on a global level where everybody can experience in the news, which was the effect of Vietnam, and then now people aren't totally involved in it as they were in the 60s because the TV body is a minor body compared to the chip body.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of America is complained about because it's not, according to the newspaper journalists, paying any attention to the Iraq War.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing about the Iraq War is...
Well, it is the biggest issue in terms of the upcoming elections.
Well, I just saw a talk by Tom Hayden, and he's got a new book, his agenda or formula for ending the Iraq War, and he was talking about, you know, Tom Hayden used to be married. Jane Fonda was the guy who started the SDS in the 60s and author of the Port Huron Statement in 62, 63.
Yeah.
Anyways, an archetypal baby boomer lefty radical, new left radical. He was saying and talking about the complexities and differences of our time, the Iraq War, compared to the previous Vietnam situation. And the problem was, he says, is to get the attention. And he says, we want to make Iraq the major issue in the debate this year, or in the election next year, and he was implying that it isn't of that status yet, but he's hoping the people will make it an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an issue for the TV body.
Yeah.
But he had there's a drifting in the audience or a loose ends kind of effect because nobody knows where the fulcrum of control is because they're dealing with these four bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Iraq is it's mainly suicidal. That's the image of charisma, is these suicide bombers blowing themselves up, which is a kind of a nihilistic way of operating the chemical body in an attempt to defeat your enemy.
He had the kamikazes in World War II.
Yeah, but that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the horror that people focus on now is the suicide bombing.
Yeah.
Young people sacrificed. It's a more dramatic situation, and it mimes the effect of the chip body on the chemical body. The chip environment annihilates the chemical body, the chemical user. Chemical
yeah,
body
I
user.
Suppose. I mean, I still tend to take the position that... Or you know, want to give credence to the idea that, you know, people become desperate enough, you know, they'll blow themselves up or what, they have nothing, they're so damn frustrated, angry, and have no place to turn, they'll blow themselves up because they don't know what else to do.
Right, and what are they blowing themselves up for, at least according to the TV body's news profiles? They're blowing themselves up for 72 virgins in the astral body.
Yeah. Well,
that's
like, you know, that's the popular meme. It's like, you know, somebody the other day said, you know, who used to work with Al Gore on his campaign, said Al Gore never said he invented the Internet. But, you know, he said something about passing legislation that had to do with the information highway, and people all blew it out of proportion, and that became the meme. So we don't know if they're doing it for 72 versions or not, but we know that...
We know that's the image that the TV body projects.
Yeah.
And to a certain level, in the realm of the TV body, that's reality.
Yeah.
Whatever icon supposedly grabs the attention of the audience, that one rules.
Yeah.
And so that's why people don't know anything about who's the president of a country, but they certainly know what the TV icons are.
See, I think it's reasonable to consider that their cultural meme in the book, I mean in the Quran, you know, is just being devastated by the Western, you know, chip body meme, and they're freaking out because they're losing their identity. You know, several thousand years of cultural identity is being X-rayed, you know, as McLuhan would say, by the TV and chip, and it's freaking them out.
Okay. Now, with that in mind, that is their chemical body, an astral body, is being wiped out, and here in America, not only is the chemical body and the astral body being wiped out, but the TV body is wiped out, so you have a little more chaotic culture here, and the chip body may be wiping out any sense of what a youth grows into. So you have this internal landscape of explosion, and the less technologized Middle East people, they express the explosion of their innards by actually externalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
But in light of all that imagery and the conflict of the four bodies, let's read the next LaRouche quote and see if the concepts resonate at all with what we're talking about from the McLuhan perspective, in a way, and see what these words do in relation to what we've just said, and whether they're distant, relevant, or a solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very things that we're going to read that he wrote. And this is from an essay written in 1974, this quote. This is that, we've quoted from this before. This is Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face, an article LaRouche wrote for The Campaigner in November, December 1974. But this is going to lay out his agenda for more hardware, what he calls in the first sentence the problem of scientific development.
Mm-hmm.
So are you ready to read this long quote?
Yeah, this is a long one.
Okay.
So bear with me as I stumble through yet another long quote.
Right. And in that particular issue of The Campaigner, if you ever run across it, it's pretty hard to find, but go to the LaRouche organization. They might have a copy you can look at. You'd find this quote on page 85 and 86 of that article.
Mm-hmm. The problem of scientific development in the setting of mathematical physics is a useful point of reference. The most wretched fallacy which might be introduced into creative scientific work is the notion that platoons of scientists working according to predetermined specific objectives are the, quote, most effective,
most efficient
mode for progress. In fact, such procedures or bureaucratic measures to similar effect are the most certain means for minimizing the gains of progress so undertaken. The process of conceptualization by which new scientific achievements are generated is an individual activity. Not only must the thinker be afforded the opportunity to think without interruptions or other interference for protracted periods, but he must have means for, quote, toying with experimental approaches as a certain features of his individualized creative activities demand. This is in brackets. Demand that he delay this until his duly elaborated proposal has been approved and the progress of fundamental scientific work virtually ends, until such a silly bureaucratic control practice ceases, end bracket. To all immediate practical intents, the process of creativity are contained within the person of the thinker and cannot be reduced to an externalizable, quote, division of supervised labor, unquote, form without destroying their integrity. This is not the complete picture. To the extent that self-consciousness is developed in creative personalities, there is a fruitful increase in the degree of communicability between the creative aspects of mental processes of all involved. This is not a dissolution of several creative intellects into one larger mass, but represents a more frequent intersection through which the partial progress of one collaborator stimulates new directions of mental activities among the others. This next sentence is all italicized. The particular creative discovery is, in every case, the private impassioned agony of the individual working in some degree of isolation. The activity of synthesis, which every relatively negentropic gestalt represents, is uniquely coextensive with the individual's cognitive processes, which cannot be directly merged in their primary form with the similar processes of other individuals. Quote, interruption, unquote, and distraction, end quote, distraction, are terms which traditionally express the destructive effects of intrusion into the necessary privacy of the creative process. The creative individual's efforts in any new undertaking begins with tugs at a few elusive clues of incommunicable prescience. The thinker seldom begins with any better assurance of a definite kind of success than the certainty that the effort will be fruitful if pursued long enough with sufficient intensity of concentration. Creative discovery is, in this sense, a process of exploration of unknown territory, for which a sense of direction, broad training, and resourcefulness are essential prerequisites. At the beginning, there can be no maps in existence of that which is to be explored, nor can one establish any meaningful schedules concerning one's intended arrival at definite new discoveries in particular. During the ensuing process, the thinker's initial partial successes do not appear as definite solutions to a pre-established problem, but only as new ways of considering a problem, or the importance of a certain detour or a new overview of the entire nature of the problem to be solved, or solutions to problems which had not been considered relevant to the original undertaking, and so on. In between each moment of articulable progress in this experience, the ongoing process assumes forms which are indispensable to accomplishment but are not susceptible of direct social expression. Although creative work is uniquely individual in those respects, it is the most social of all activities. The development of the mental processes in preparation for creative work is entirely social. Not only are actions impinging upon...
Not only are the actions.
Are the actions impinging upon the individual's development social, but the content of this influence reflects the internal geometry of society. In fact, it is to the extent that the individual apprehends his experience in just such terms that he is orienting the results of his experience for fruitful creative efforts. Similarly, the definition of problems requiring solution is determined by social criteria as social criteria on the broadest scale of reference determine which hypotheses represent probable insight solutions to these problems. The distinctive outlook of the creative thinker is associated with the extent of its scope of reference in respect to the much greater breadth of its current relevance and its historical setting. The conceptions and principles of scientific work are the accumulated accomplishment of approximately six centuries of European progress since the early period of the Renaissance. They have been evolved under the impact of changes in technology as such and changes in the social relations through which technology is realized. The characteristic interchangeable terms of creative effort are, quote, universal, quote, fundamental, and, quote, revolutionary.
So there's a lot of stuff in there. Certainly couldn't spell that out on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be read, and the individual cogitates on it, meditates on it, thinks about it, gets guidelines from it, and then has to find an isolated place, a laboratory, to develop it. They need silence.
Mm-hmm.
No interruptions. Think of the, they'd have to get rid of their cell phone to do LaRouchean science.
Hmm.
You couldn't have people phoning in all the time if you're going to get some valid thinking done, is what he's suggesting, right?
On the flip side of that is, it seemed like Finnegan's Wake, one of the major things that it wanted to point out was that interruptions, fits, and starts had to be accommodated at every step of the way.
That's what the Wake does?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
Because of the way it reads,
yeah.
In these disjointed, you think there's a moment of continuity, and then it's interrupted.
Right. Now that'd be why LaRouche said that James Joyce destroyed the English language.
Mm-hmm.
He says James Joyce was a great destructive force for the kind of creativity that LaRouche is discussing in the paragraphs we just read.
Mm. He destroyed the English language, wow.
Yeah.
Well, can't LaRouche even appreciate how deviant the guy, I mean, the guy, if he was deviant, he was still a genius.
Well, what was he a genius about?
Who, Joyce?
Yeah.
Well, you know, nobody was ever able to do what he did.
Yeah, some people say he had verbal diarrhea, or diarrhea of the pen, I should say.
Mm.
Diarrhea of the pen.
Yeah.
But well, it's verbal because he, stream of consciousness, a lot of inner voice and interaction and verbal interplay going on.
The, I guess the existentialist guys think that narrative is something that we overlay on top of a bunch of discontinuous moments of experience that have no connection. But then, you know...
That's another guy LaRouche thinks was evil, is Jean-Paul Sartre and the existentialists.
Right.
He puts a lot of blame on those guys.
Yeah, but how do we know that the way in which LaRouche strings moments together, even if it is useful, isn't just a pattern, an imaginary pattern that he's constructed, that, you know, he's putting forward as being the way things should be?
Well, he says that's half of the issue. The momentary sensory data, he called the discrete manifold, but the higher idea of thought realm, he called the continuous manifold. And so the discrete manifold was always in this process of becoming and approaching the being of the continuous manifold, which contained all time and space and endless technologies, like
he
an Akashic Records
must
almost.
He thought that was an emanation of, you know, the sort of, quote, mind of God or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because where else could such perfect ideals come from?
You're saying you've always thought that?
No, I didn't say that. I'm just saying where else could, if he's intuiting these, what did you call the continuous manifold, the higher, you know?
Yeah, that would be the God.
The higher realm of ideas.
Yeah.
Well, where did those ideas come from? I mean, if we're sitting there, if LaRouche is sitting there trying to logically deduce those ideas and those rules, well, they were there before he attempted to understand them, and so who put them there? It could only be, you know, the mind of God, as it were.
Yeah, the continuous manifold, which he would agree with you that we're discovering what is already there.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if Plato...
And we're approaching the continuous through the discrete manifold's discoveries and fragmentations and improvements and stutterings and startings. That approximates the continuous manifold,
uh-huh.
Which is like the ideal Platonic archetype.
Right.
And we see fragments of it. But what were you going to say? I think you.
Well,
were...
I don't know if Plato believed this. I know Aristotle and philosophers succeeding Aristotle wrestled with the issue of, well, once you get into the realm of the continuous manifold, you're getting into the realm of the movement ideas and the movement of celestial bodies and so on, but they must ultimately emanate from the unmoved mover.
That's what they used to say.
Well, yeah. And there was always this philosophical conundrum of how do we go from the unmoved mover to the first movements of the heavens and of the world of ideas, which then weave themselves into patterns which end up into creating, you know, the physical dimensions and the imperfect world and the corruptible world and so on.
Yeah. That's the world we live in, the corruptible world, the world of becoming.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor for the being world, which we can't know completely yet.
Mm-hmm.
We just know it's there, and if we keep approaching it, we'll get more approximation to it in the world of becoming,
mm-hmm.
get better technologies.
Yeah. But I think they thought that God must be even more perfect than the realm of the perfected ideas. The realm of perfected ideas had to emanate from some perfectly still source, which was unmoved. And so, you know, how do you cross the barrier from no energy to energy, or from no movement to the first movements?
Right, and in Thompson's section, or Thompson's chart, this unmoved mover is the geometrical phase, the geometry phase, what he called the geometric universe. What was it, the geometric...
Well, first there was arithmetic, and then geometry, and then algebra.
Mentality, yeah. The geometric mentality is this ideal static zone that mm-hmm. Plato and Chinese temples...
Right, the five Platonic solids, which... Now, I think Plato actually... I don't think they really originated with him. I think they might have originated with Pythagoras or someone before... I don't know if Pythagoras was before Plato, but...
Well, he was. And no, LaRouche says it comes from Egyptian temples, that Moses brought that knowledge into, pre-Christian, old Hebraic culture.
Yeah.
And then that got into the Greek culture.
Hmm.
So LaRouche sees it going way back.
Yeah. Now, one thing I actually wondered about LaRouche, you know, everybody who is religious, you know, says, you know, Jesus was the big guy. I mean, there was no one greater. But I'm wondering if from LaRouche's perspective, because he says he likes Jesus because Jesus democratizes what Plato realized. I wonder if he would put Plato above Jesus. Say, well, you know, Plato is the guy who came up with all the ideas. Jesus just came along and democratized it, which was a big deal, but it didn't originate with him.
Yeah, well, it didn't originate with Plato either.
Yeah.
I mean, he goes back, he takes it back to Sanskrit culture.
Mm. That would be before Moses then, huh?
Yeah. And the, so he
sees this as being intrinsic in the creation.
Right. If a culture grows with, you know, wise leaders and Republican impulses and tries to improve its lot, then these thoughts will naturally come into that culture.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a degraded leadership, then the opposite, non-thoughts, sensory, pantheistic, pagan hedonism and rutting and rooting will be the effect.
Right. Because I like it.
You see, there's slightly a McLuhan level of the medium is the message. If the leaders create the right medium, then these thoughts will unfold.
Yeah, that's right.
It's an efficient causality version
Call LaRouche up and remind him of that.
Yeah, it's an efficient causality mm-hmm. of reason or of the medium. You know, Aristotle's four causes. The formal causality studies the effect on the audience. The efficient causality figures out how to make it. The material causality is the category for what goes into making it. And the final causality is the end result.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan would sit around and study the effects of the technology, and LaRouche would say, nah, we need to create a medium that creates new technologies that can be usurped by even later technologies, regardless of the effects, because if we keep making better technology, we won't get into the negative effects of a limited technology.
Yeah.
And McClone says, well, wait a minute. These technologies have psychic sensory effects that might frustrate your movement forward.
Didn't you say once that the Evergreen said that the technology we've created has gone beyond what the UFOs have created? The UFOs are flying around looking at the technology we live inside of, and they're scratching their heads and going, how did they do it?
Yeah, the Evergreens don't say that. That was my idea. The Evergreens, they talk about the Boothian culture, live in such a different climate or environment. It's almost like a very hot beehive is what their sensory existence is, and they don't have the same kind of geographic, metallic, physical environment on our planet. They don't have that. So to us, it's a hard, from their point of view, we're in a harder, less fluid environment. And they're amazed at how we work within that environment.
Mm.
They don't work in that kind of medium.
We circumvent the fact that I can't even, if you're 500 feet away from me, I can't even yell at you, but I can create a telephone and then circumvent that.
Right. So that they said that about the Boothians, but I took the McClune point that we're super angels. If a UFO is like an angel and it goes wherever it wants at pretty fast speeds, but only the number of people in the UFO or make up that angel get to experience the travel or the places they arrive at. But with television and the modern internet, everybody experiences the same space. Millions of people can experience the same content. Let's say millions of people are watching a Super Bowl game. You've got not 45 people like might be on a UFO, or even if there's 10,000 people on a UFO, a big mothership, you've got people traveling and experiencing multisensory information, acoustic, visual, kinetic, smell, taste, billions of people, a billion people, say, for an Olympics thing. They're all inside this vehicle, and they're traveling, but it's not a kinetic movement. But they are experiencing a movement internally or proprioceptively or in their mind.
Yeah, but one would, assume or deduce or be inclined to think that if we haven't reached speed of light, warp speed, interdimensional travel, spaceship stuff, and they have, that they must have already gone through our phase and beyond it.
Well, yeah, in terms of kinetic movement.
Well, in terms of having developed their own communication systems along the way before they ever even left their planet.
Yeah, maybe they have some kind of very intimate EST.
Mm-hmm.
But I said that our situation is quite unique because we've externalized our ESP abilities and made a very evolving global membrane that they may never have encountered before and are puzzled by. The effects on us and what happens to us.
Well, do you find yourself always falling into suit with the Evergreens, or are there places, points of departure where you think you might have a grander perspective than they do?
The only thing was that they certainly didn't have McClune around them until I started asking questions about McClune, and then McClune, or Spirit Claiming to be McClune, came in and... So I did many sessions through the years talking to McClune, and at one point the Evergreens said that they've learned stuff from McClune.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if the two worlds meet. I don't know if what they know is applicable to what McClune knows. They're in the astral plane, so they may have a totally different experience and a form of knowing what's going on here way beyond what we can know while we're here.
Yeah.
So... you're wondering if I knew more than them.
Well, if in some arenas you feel like you may have snuck around some of the things that they know, and you may have know something more.
Well, terms of talking to other humans,
mm-hmm.
what the Evergreens can say verbally, I can supersede by pointing to the post-verbal environment that our electronic, digital, Android meme creates. So for the human listener, the chemical body listener, I could sound like I know and talk more than the Evergreens. Because the Evergreens, they can't present videos.
Mm-hmm.
They just talk through Michael Blake Reed's mouth. Mm-hmm. So it's largely verbal.
Yeah.
So they have a limited medium to work with.
Right.
So they can't go more than what the verbal medium can express, or and it's limited. So if I can use, just on the radio show, if I got, in the old days, with Mike Dyer being the co-host, he would put other musics underneath you. You can't have music while you're experiencing the Evergreens.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know. When I listen to the Evergreens, I feel like I'm sitting at, you know, Socrates' feet back in, you know, while he's sitting on a stone slab or something, you know?
Yeah, it's sensorially limited compared to the jumping about you can do on the Internet.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like talking to the Evergreens, like talking to an angel.
Mm-hmm.
And it can take you through all kinds of scenarios of information from all parts of history and the future. And that's pretty interesting if you have the time to verbally take it in, or to listen to it. So the sensory mix of our time is, you've just pointed out what I was saying, is that the UFOs are like angels, like what comes through the Evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
They could, kinetically, if you jump on their spaceship, it might be fun to zip around and go to different places, but I was thinking 5 minutes ago that if I was on a moonshot, or had to get on, you know, go down to NASA and get on a rocket and go up there, I think it'd be pretty confining sitting in that can for 2 months or something.
Mm-hmm.
You might be trained to handle it, but unless you had your internet, you or a lot of Walkman tapes, you might find it pretty monastic compared to what you would do here.
Yeah.
In the same period of time.
Yeah.
And so you just expressed that. You found there's a kind of monochromatic level to experiencing the Evergreens on tape compared to what you absorb every day with your different media.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like people, they don't read books.
Mm-hmm.
It's too limited.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
part
of the problem.
What's interesting about the Evergreens is that you really feel like they, you know, especially if somebody asks a question or they're just talking in general, they have a really very personal interest in who you are, and that they're, you know, that they're being careful to communicate to you because it means something to them, that there's some personal exchange going on between you and them. It seems to be very, you know, that personal touch seems to be very meaningful to them.
Yeah, because from their perspective, that person is almost like a god. That person has 3,000 lives going on, and they're talking to the Oversoul.
Oh.
You know, they're talking to one part of that entity when they die, and they get reunited with their Oversoul,
mm-hmm.
or some term like that, which is all 3,000 lives going on at once. There's a lot of rich energy going on in there, and that's what the Evergreens respect, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they take each person as a whole universe.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if people listen to these dialogues we're doing, that's pretty skimpy, thin medium, just us talking.
Yeah.
And quoting from books.
Yeah. Yeah. But you have a kind of buoyancy or some secret sauce or something going on. It doesn't matter what you're saying. You're kind of fun to listen to.
All right. Okay, so I'm a rhetorician.
I guess.
Yeah, I have good effects.
Yeah.
And opinion varies, but there are certain kind of people that like what I present, or they like listening.
Uh-huh.
Others don't, but we'll count on a few people being interested because they want to hear me talk.
Right. But I imagine, you know, the people who aren't interested in listening to you, you don't treat them any less respectfully than you treat people who are interested in listening to you.
No, I respect them even more.
Oh.
And my listeners.
Oh, no. Bob, after all this time, I finally discovered that you like the wino on the street. You have more respect for him than you do for me.
Well, we are in session 44, the magic number of this decade, so a little truth should come through on this tape. But, no, I respect him, but somebody you respect is like an enemy. You... you watch yourself around them.
Yeah.
You know, if someone agrees to vibe with you, respect doesn't come into it. You just enjoy the dance.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry about upsetting the person.
That's true.
You know, respect is an interesting concept. You respect people who you don't know and
are
unpredictable.
There's a bit of authority thing going on in there with respect, I guess.
Yeah, a bit of unfamiliarity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, who calls you Mr. Norris? Probably a customs agent. Go to customs.
Yeah, the guy at the grocery store. I hate it when they do that. I give them my card, you know, because I want to pay, and when they run my card and my name comes up on the screen, and then they start addressing me as Mr. Norris. I'm like, dude, you don't even know me. Forget it.
Right, but it's a formality, the way he's using it. He has to say something.
Yeah, well,
Scott.
You know.
He respects you, so he calls you Mr.
I know.
Mr. Norris. I mean, it's interesting, you know, you bump
a nod in a wink. A nod in a wink is good enough for me. A friendly hello, whatever.
No, he respects you, so he's going to say your name. Like, if you're in a crowd and you'll see these cops, maybe they need to move the crowd around, do something, they'll say, sir. They'll even say it to a wino. They'll say, sir, would you mind moving over there? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're right. Authority and respect is due to lack of intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, I respect people who don't take an interest in me
mm-hmm.
or don't like my presentation.
Right.
But we don't need no stinking respect when we're doing this stuff.
Right.
Okay, so from the long LaRouche quote that you just read, the opening statement is, the problem of scientific development in the setting of mathematical physics is a useful point of reference. Now, imagine him at the National Press Club giving a press conference on the economy has just collapsed and it's national bankruptcy, and LaRouche has now got an audience for his solution to the situation. So he begins by saying at the press conference with the flashing light bulbs and cameras, or they don't have light bulbs anymore, the flashing digitals. So he says, the problem of scientific development in the setting of mathematical physics is a useful point of reference. Then he goes, the most wretched fallacy which might be introduced into creative scientific work is the notion that platoons of scientists working according to predetermined specific objectives are the most efficient mode for progress. In fact, such procedures or bureaucratic measures to similar effect are the most certain means for minimizing the gains of progress so undertaken.
Now, can you repeat that in English?
Yeah. Actually, we're reading what he wrote, and he would not necessarily speak this way, but he would make the same point. He would say, onward to better machine tools, reinvigorate the nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, they are doing that around the world, and he's celebrating that the use of renewed valuation of nuclear power plants is happening around the world, and he thinks that's great. Of course, you know, In the meantime,
I think as far as we know, the core that melted down in Russia is still burning.
Okay, so here's LaRouche presents this, and it actually would maybe he wouldn't have a press conference. He'd present it to the president's cabinet. It's more of a star chamber kind of thing. It's more for an elite group to develop a policy, and then the president would come out if LaRouche wasn't president, and they would give the popular version of this.
Mm-hmm.
But would the population be listening? Yeah, I guess if the economy collapsed, they'd be paying attention.
Yeah. But see, that's where he loses his most credibility, is the fact that he's been going around predicting the collapse of the economy for 30 years and it never collapsed.
Yeah, now he does say it's collapsed, but he sees that the
He can't go back on what he said. He said it would collapse and we would go back into the Dark Ages and would be, you know, what did they have in the Dark Ages? You had monarchies or something?
And disease. No, it's interesting. There's a few points where LaRouche kind of takes on that objection.
Mm-hmm.
that you're pointing out. And he says, you're not understanding that the collapse has already happened and that we've been in a world of rampant disease, and like he sees AIDS as a product of this degeneration of social hygiene and hospital deterioration, all this stuff. We've been in the collapse. But he does predict we get to a point where it's really like official, and then nobody knows what to do. And maybe wars, a few wars break out. Now, he's been saying that there have been wars as relief mechanisms, and he'll criticize the tax derivative or the pump-and-dump stock market. He sees all these things as a degenerate post-collapse culture.
Yeah.
And he sees the American population as incredibly stupid.
Yeah. Well, if the economy ran on the dollar, his predictions probably would have come true. But as you've pointed out, the dollar has been superseded.
Right. The virtual economy, which Croker deals with, is not in the view of LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
He does not see that. Here is the digital economy, as Croker says it. So here's what's going on while LaRouche is writing articles, long essays, from Croker. Just taking a quote from random from his section of my book. Between ecstasy and fear, between delirium and anxiety, between the triumph of cyberpunk and the political reality of cultural exhaustion, that is the emotional mood line of Panic Encyclopedia or Our Time. Here, in fact, panic has the reverse meaning of its classical sense. In antiquity, the appearance of the god Pan meant a moment of arrest, a sudden calm, a rupture point between frenzy and reflection. Not though in the postmodern condition, just like the reversal of classical cynicism or kynicism, philosophy from below, into postmodern cynicism for the ruling elites before it, just like the reversal before. The classical meaning of panic has now disappeared into its opposite sense. In the postmodern scene, panic signifies a twofold freefall, the disappearance of external standards of public conduct, when the social self becomes a transparent field of a cynical power, and the dissolution of the internal foundations of identity. The disappearing ego is the victory sign of postmodernism, when the self is transformed into an empty screen of an exhausted but hyper-technical culture. Panic? That is the dominant psychology of the fully technological self, living at the vanishing point where postmodern science and culture interpolate as reverse mirror images in a common power field. That's what LaRouche is not focusing on.
Does Croker critique LaRouche ever?
Well, we just have that one quote, which we used,
and
that was from another writer, but Croker would have been the editor of the magazine, this one it was done in print.
Apparently Croker doesn't take LaRouche seriously enough to actually bother to critique him.
Yeah, well, they had to. They did this in 86, 87, right when LaRouche hit his peak, you know, when he was being interviewed by Larry King and some of his lieutenants won in the Chicago Illinois primary for state legislature stuff, and it was just before he got raided. Because LaRouche was in the mainstream news then, Croker and them had to deal with it. So reading the last line of this guy's essay in Croker's journal, he says, over the past 20 years, individuals like Joseph McCarthy, Lyndon LaRouche, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, etc., have succeeded in imposing themselves upon the public. By profiting from the civil apathy and political ignorance of the North American population through the process of scapegoating. Products of the myth of consensus, these men have also contributed to its destruction. That would be maybe Croker's opinion of LaRouche.
Mm.
A scapegoater.